Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, January 6th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, Mark Schwann will be here with a preview of his talk on Thursday about birding and gamble. Samantha Weinstein and Mandy Malott will be here to offer details about upcoming inaugural activities. We'll highlight National Mentoring Month and Big Brothers Big Sisters. And Lori Craig will be here with a preview of this year's Fireside Lecture Series at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Those interviews, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This week, we're taking a look at some of the impacts climate change has on Alaska Native people. Today, we explore the importance of wild foods to Alaskans, especially in rural areas. KMBA's Jocelyn Estes reports on warming temperatures and subsistence.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says foods such as moose, caribou, walrus, seal, waterfowl, and salmon, plus greens gathered from nature, make up a large share of the food supply in rural Alaska, about 375 pounds per person per year, compared to 22 pounds per person in urban areas. Stanley Hawley, tribal administrator for Kivalina in northwest Alaska, says the gathering and sharing of wild foods involves more than putting food on the table.
Once we get exposed to that livelihood, that way of living, it gets ingrained in our spirit, and in our soul, and in our psyche.
According to a health assessment of Kivalina by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, sea ice that reliably formed every fall provided a stable surface for travel and hunting. But in recent years, the ice has been thinner and sometimes is not there when marine mammals migrate offshore headed south. Without sea ice, it takes more gasoline and it's more dangerous to travel the greater distances. Thinning ice keeps fishermen from setting nets in rivers, and wet spring weather interferes with the smoking and drying of fish. Salmon harvests on the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers have been sharply reduced, but still, sometimes too few fish are left to spawn in the numbers needed to maintain the population. Villagers fear hunger will become an issue if climate change affects the already declining numbers of salmon. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The South Dakota Public Utilities Commission is expected to address the Keystone Pipeline today at its commission meeting. The commission granted a permit for the project in 2010, but because it's been at least 4 years and the pipeline was not built, TransCanada seeks reapproval. The project would deliver oil from Canada to the Gulf Coast. According to the commission, the pipeline would run through several South Dakota counties and include several pumping stations. Individual Native Americans and tribes are among opponents of the pipeline project. Native leaders and activists have been voicing concerns across the country, saying it's a threat to their homelands and the environment. Demonstrations have taken place in the nation's capital, and a group has also been occupying a protest camp on the pipeline route near the Rosebud Reservation. In December, the Yankton Sioux Tribe filed a motion with the Utilities Commission for dismissal. Supporters of the pipeline say it will bring jobs and boost the economy. Navajo lawmakers will be sworn in next week in Fort Defiance, Arizona. The Navajo Nation Council is made up of 24 members. The inauguration comes as the tribe still debates what to do about the presidential election, which was postponed in November. 17 candidates ran for office in the August 2014 primary. One of the top two candidates was disqualified after his Navajo language fluency was challenged. The presidential election has since been playing out in tribal government and in court. Last week, the Navajo Nation Council approved legislation for a special runoff election and a special general election for president and vice president. If signed into law, the runoff election would take place in June, the special general election would be held in August, and the swearing-in of a new president would happen in September. The council has not received word yet from current President Ben Shelley if he'll approve or veto the legislation. Shelley was given 10 days to decide. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 6 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, January 6, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton, and in the studio now is Mark Schwann. He'll be giving a presentation this Thursday night at Centennial Hall about birding in Gamble. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Scott.
Nice to have you here today. So, Mark, you're a longtime Juneau resident. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into birding in the first place.
Sure. Well, I've lived in Juneau since about 1979. I'm a retired fisheries biologist for the state of Alaska. I did my college work mostly up at Fairbanks and a little bit down in California where I grew up. So between my stays in Fairbanks, I took some classes at a state university in California, and I was surrounded by bird watchers, birders. And I kind of got hooked. It's a great excuse to get outside, get some exercise, see different parts of the world or the country. And it works your brain, works your eyes, and it's a challenge, and you know, there's always something new to learn. I'm certainly not an expert, so it's just a lot of fun, and I've enjoyed it. It's a major pastime for me, you know, in my life.
Oh, good. And when did you start taking trips to other parts of the state or the world to see birds, would you say?
Oh, I think the first trip I took was with Bob Armstrong back in 1987 to Nome. Spent about 10, 12 days in the Nome area birding with Bob. That was, the first trip I took like that, some kind of more remote part of the state.
All right. And then eventually you've made it to St. Lawrence Island and to Gamble.
Right. In 2012, we had an invitation. My wife, Debbie Ballum, who's a nurse, a former coworker of hers, Cecilia Watson, was the healthcare provider up at Gamble. And she invited Debbie to come out and visit her and said, you ought to bring Mark along because, you know, people like to come here and look at the birds. And I went, yeah, no kidding. So we went and stayed with Cecilia and Stan in the spring of 2012. And then I went back just last fall by myself to bird.
And in case our listeners can't picture where St. Lawrence Island is, I think of it as sort of just directly west of Nome. Is that how you would describe it, too, or
well,
is it southwest?
Kind of southwest.
Southwest.
St. Lawrence Island is about 100 miles long, and Gamble's on the very northern tip of it. Gamble's maybe 200 miles southwest of Nome, but it's much it's actually much closer to Russia. You can see Russia from Gamble. You're about 36, 38 miles away from the Russian mainland.
And I think that's something I read about your presentation on Thursday. It's the birds, but it's also sort of the geographic interest and also some social interest in, as well. Can you tell us what you like about Gamble?
Well, it is sort of kind of crazy just to go, gee, you look on a clear day, you look off the water and say, that's Russia over there. You know, you really can see Russia from there. And it's fascinating to be in it's a Siberian Yupik community and subsistence way of life. So you see whale carcasses and bones and skulls all over the place and meat hanging and drying. That's kind of, you know, that's different, kind of fun to see that. But the birding is spectacular in terms of the numbers of birds because the Bering Sea is so productive that millions of puffins, alcids, crested auklets, parakeet auklets, these small fish-eating birds, like kind of related like to our marbled murrelet around here. There are big colonies near there, and on a daily basis, when you just watch birds moving back and forth, you can see hundreds of thousands in a day. And in the fall, short-tailed shearwaters are in the northern Pacific and the Bering Sea, and you can see in excess of 1 million short-tailed shearwaters in one day. So the numbers of birds is kind of mind-boggling. You know, it's not huge numbers of species, but the abundance of some of the birds there is phenomenal.
Yeah, and so when you go bird watching there in Gamble, do you tend to take a lot of pictures? Are you actually watching through binoculars, combination of both?
Yeah, all of those. Spotting scopes, binoculars, and camera with the telephoto lenses. I've got some pictures. My pictures aren't great. I'm not the best photographer, but I've got some pictures to support the talk. I've got a few pictures my wife took with her iPhone. And a good birding friend from Fairbanks who was there last fall has loaned me a couple of his pictures or a few of his pictures, too. So I've got photographic support, but it's not like a, wow, amazing, look at that picture, look at this picture. It's more of examples of the kinds of things you can see there, in terms of regular occurring birds and a few of the vagrants. That's the other thing that makes it a big draw for people is being so close to Russia. You get these Palearctic, these old world species that nest very close, but really hardly ever get into North America. But when they're migrating, they kind of can, because Gamble's so close, some of those species come through Gamble. And so folks can see these old world forms that you don't really get to see anywhere else in North America. There's an array of old world warblers and flycatchers that are just distinctly different. And so that's a big draw for people to see those birds, the big numbers of the seabirds, and then what other birds that are called Beringian migrants, basically birds that come across the Bering Strait and nest in western Alaska. Things like white wagtail, yellow wagtail, blue throat, wheat ear, Arctic warbler, things that do nest in Alaska, but have restricted ranges in North America and Alaska. And you can see those birds in the Nome area and the Seward Peninsula, but you can also see them in migration, in Gamble.
You're listing off a lot of birds. May I ask, not to put you on the spot, Mark, are you a kind of person that documents every time that you see a bird?
I'm not as fastidious as a lot of people are. I keep a list and I keep notes, but there are a number of people I know that are way better at it than I am.
I was going to ask you off the top of your head, how many you think you've seen?
In Alaska?
Yes.
Oh, I think in Alaska maybe 326 species or something like that.
All right. What can folks expect on Thursday night?
There'll be a few kind of set the stage, like some of the questions you've asked. Where is Gamble? Where is St. Lawrence Island? What makes it special for birders? A few scenes of around the town, a few pictures of sea watch activities and the birds that you see doing that, and then some just sort of exploring around what are called the boneyards, basically these old middens where remains of animals have been placed for hundreds of years. And the local people, they dig for old ivory, for carving. The people there are noted ivory carvers. And so they dig in these boneyards, and the boneyards have more vegetation than other places. So a number of the birds will hide out in these boneyard areas. So there's a lot of walking around in these boneyard areas looking for small birds. It's kind of that's a little tough, uneven ground. And in the fall, the vegetation's a lot higher, so it's hard to see some of those birds. And they aren't numerous sometimes. And that's what reminds me. When you go there, you need to get a kind of a permit to access the land. The Native Corporation there, you just buy a $50 permit and allows you to access the kind of the immediate area in the around the village.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be, so for more details and to meet Mark in person, you can go to Centennial Hall, the Egan Room, this Thursday night at 7 p.m. and hear all about things Gamble, birding, St. Lawrence Island, and more. Mark, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that's it. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This is Bird Note. The tiniest hummingbird and the 250-pound ostrich have at least one thing in common. Like all birds, they lay eggs, precision-engineered and wrapped in an exquisite shell made of calcium. That key ingredient, calcium, is needed on demand and in larger quantities than the female typically has in her bloodstream. So birds have a trick or two up their sleeves or in their legs. just as their bodies form the first cells of an egg, the birds start to assemble a special stash of mostly calcium in the hollow space in their leg bones. It's called medullary bone. As the egg develops, that stored calcium is rapidly dissolved and sent from inside the leg to the shell gland, then formed into the new shell, ready for laying in the nest. Just how every bird species supplies or stores calcium for egg laying isn't fully known yet. Some birds appear to rely on other, more immediate sources of calcium, like consuming calcium-rich grit from the ground. And some Arctic nesting shorebirds have evolved an especially clever trick. Just in time for egg laying, they ingest the teeth and bones from lemming skeletons to stock up on calcium. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. I'm Michael Stein.
The Juno Arts and Humanities Council proudly presents The Intergalactic Nemesis, Target Earth, a live-action graphic novel. Tuesday, January 20th, 7 p.m. at the JDHS Auditorium. Radio play meets comic book and a live adventure for the kid and everyone. A must-see if you are a fan of awesome. That's January 20th at JDHS Auditorium. Tickets at the Jack, Hearthside Books, Rainy Retreat, and online at jahc.org.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, January 6th, 2015. It's about 21 minutes after the hour. I'm your host, Scott Burton, and in the studio now is the Juno Gala Coordinator, Sam Weinstein. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you. And let's see if I get this right, Mandy. The statewide co-chair of the inaugural ball committee in 2015, Mandy Mallott.
That's correct.
All right.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming down. This must be exciting. It's this Saturday, the inauguration ball. Yeah.
We are really excited to get this going.
So tell me about it. What have been some of your jobs in getting this going, Sam? I imagine they are many.
A lot of delegating. We have about 20 volunteers helping out with the planning, and they've been getting together entertainment, food and drinks, and just organizing it so that there's something for everyone and we all have a fun night.
All right. And so it's this Saturday. Why don't we just talk about really quick sort of the times and what's going to be going on, and then we can talk about more details later.
Well, Centennial Hall and the Jack are both going to open up at 8 p.m., and we're going to have live music at both locations from 8 until midnight. At midnight, everyone's going to head over to the Jack for the after party. So all night we're at Centennial Hall, we're going to have Thunder Mountain Big Band featuring the Miss Ain't Behavin' Trio. And we're going to have a couple different options at the Jack. We're going to start out with the Njuzu Marimba Band and then doing Susu and the Prophets, classic rock, from 10 until 2 a.m.
All right. That sounds like a lot of fun. And going back to Centennial Hall, you mentioned like a dessert bar and a no-host bar. And tell us more about that.
We've got a no-host bar going in both locations all night, so 8 until last call. And we are going to have a dessert bar opening up at 10. There's going to be a bunch of stuff that I can't eat, so cheesecakes, and I think we've got little cream puff things, and there's even going to be a cheese and crackers and fruit platter. So it's going to be absolutely delicious.
I bet. Mandy, will you tell us how you are related to the Lieutenant Governor?
I am related to the Lieutenant Governor because I am married to his son, Anthony.
Okay.
Yes.
And how have you been involved in the planning of this gala?
I am involved because as Byron and Tony's daughter-in-law, I was asked to co-chair the statewide committee with the governor and first lady's daughter, Lindsay. So Lindsay and I felt like it would be a great opportunity for us to work together and do our part in facilitating the statewide event. All of the events statewide.
How many are you going to be doing?
There are right now 8 different events happening across the state. So it's really an exciting time for all Alaskans because we're trying to, or we aren't just trying, we are getting into some of the smaller locations. Also, we're outside of just Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. We have events in Nome, the Kenai Peninsula, the Mat-Su. There's an event happening in Palmer. So they're happening. One will be happening in March in Ketchikan. So we're really trying to get out and welcome as many Alaskans as we can to join us. Not all of the events across the state are fancy galas like we have here in Juneau. We have afternoon events that are more reception-type things happening, and parade. There's going to be a parade in Nome and different things like that. So it's really exciting.
Okay. Sam, how would you describe what Saturday night's going to look like as far as interaction with the governor and the lieutenant governor? Are they going to be giving speeches? Are people going to be able to shake their hands? What do you see the format looking like?
You know, considering the behavior on the campaign trail, I can't see either our new governor or our new lieutenant governor hiding themselves at all during the evening. They're going to be escorted in around 8:30 by the Yiku dancers. And we may let them say a few words before the dance performance commences, but we really want the night to be about mingling. They're Juno's newest neighbors, and people want to get to know their neighbors, so that's what the night's about.
And I also noticed no suits and ties, or you can if you want, but that's not an emphasis on that, right?
It's Alaska formal. You don't have to go out and rent a tux. If you don't want to buy a new dress, don't worry about it. Just show up and have fun.
You were going to add something, Mandy?
Well, I was just going to echo what Sam said, that both the governor and Lieutenant Governor are just delighted to be around Alaskans and are very happy to engage with them. So that really is what this is about here in Juneau and across the state.
All right. If somebody wants to go, what should they do?
Well, we are going to have free parking all night, all over downtown on Saturday. So you can come down early, go to dinner at one of the many restaurants we have in downtown Juneau, and just walk on over. There are going to be buses that can bring people down from Nugget Mall. We're going to have two leaving, and we're going to be putting those details and times on our Facebook page. And our event page is the 2015 Juneau Inaugural Gala. So find it, like it, and you'll get all the details. One of the other fun things you can find on the event page are the special rates that the Baranoff is offering for Friday and Saturday night. And if you go on the Facebook page, you can find the code that they'll ask for when you go to get yourself a room.
Okay, and what about tickets?
Tickets, there are still general admission tickets available. You can pick those up at the Jack or at Hearthside Books. You can also go to jahc.org and get them on their buy ticket site.
Okay. Sounds like a lot of fun this Saturday at 8 p.m., kicking it off, going until 2 a.m.
Oh, it's going to be a blast. We're going to party all night long.
All right, sounds like fun. Sam Weinstein, Mandy Mollat, thanks for your time today. Are we missing anything?
I think we've got everything, but I do want to point out that we also have a really great opportunity to pass along some commemorative items for everyone who's coming to the event. We're going to have pins available for everyone.
Yep. Tana Peters, a local Juneau gal, did the design work on the flyer, and we're doing commemorative pins.
And
we'll have those and also some other treats.
For people who were fast enough snatching up table seats, we're going to have two very beautiful Rhi Munoz prints available for everyone with a table seat.
Sounds great. Sam, one more time, the Facebook page name?
2015 Juneau Inaugural Gala.
Great. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 6th of January, 2015. It was on this day in 1942, the first around-the-world commercial flight landed in New York City at the seaplane base at LaGuardia Airport. It was a Boeing 314 called the Pacific Clipper, flown by Pan American Airways. A luxurious plane carried 74 passengers, had couches and thick walls, a lounge. Passengers at meals sat down at tables covered with fine linen. The food was served on china plates. It's the birthday of E.L. Doctorow, born in New York City, 1931, author of the Book of Daniel, author of Ragtime. E.L. Doctorow, who said, "Writing is like driving a car at night. You never see further than your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way." Doctorow also said, "I don't want a style. I think that the minute a writer knows what his style is, he's finished, because then you see your own limits and you hear your own voice in your head. At that point, you might as well close up shop." It was on this day, 2001, George W. Bush was certified the winner of the 2000 presidential election. It all came down to Florida, came down to a collection of disputed Florida ballots. And the Supreme Court voted 5-4 to stop Florida's manual recount. And so the electoral votes were awarded to Bush. It's the birthday of the novelist Elizabeth Strout, Portland, Maine, 1956, author of Amy and Isabel, her first novel, 1998, and her collection of stories, Olive Kittredge, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Elizabeth Strout, who said, "I write pieces and move them around, and the fun of it is watching the truthful parts slide together. What is false won't fit." Here's a poem for today by Stephen Dunn entitled Stories. It was back when we used to listen to stories, our minds developing pictures as we were taken into the elsewhere of our experience. or to the forbidden or under the sea. Television was wrestling Milton Berle, believe it or not. We knelt before it like natives in front of something sent by parachute. But when Grandfather said, "I'll tell you a story," we stopped with pleasure, sat cross-legged next to the fireplace, waited. He'd sip gin and hold us, his voice, the extra truth beyond what we believed, without question. When Grandfather died and changed what an evening meant, it was 1954. After supper, we went to the television. Innocence in a magic land getting more innocent, 1,000 years away from Oswald and the shock, the end of our enormous childhood. We sat still for anything, laughed when anyone slipped or lisped or got hit with a pie. We said to our friends, "What the hey," and punched them in the arms. The television had arrived and was coming. Throughout the country, all the grandfathers were dying, giving their reluctant permission like Indians. A poem by Stephen Dunn, stories from his collection Local Time, published by Quill Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Cabot Creamery Cooperative, Northeast farm families who make cheddar cheese and award volunteers for their commitment at rewardvolunteers.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD in Southeast communities through Pick, Click, Give. There are over 36 causes based in the Juneau-Douglas area alone, including KTOO Public Radio. More information can be found at pickclickgive.org.
It's about 34 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday. Scott Burton, your host, and now in the studio is the program specialist, Mr. Joe Clark of Big Brothers and Big Sisters. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah. And also one of the big sisters here in the community, Leslie Lyman. Welcome, Leslie.
Hi.
It's nice to have you both down here today. So it is National Mentoring Month. Joe,
right.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is just a great month to think about people who have mentored us in our lives, possibly consider volunteering with us as a mentor, be one of those adults that is helping to raise positive people in our community. National Mentoring Month doesn't stop at Big Brothers, Big Sisters. We like to take this month as just a reminder of all the people who have helped us grow into the folks that we are now.
Absolutely. I think we've all probably had somebody that we need to thank, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Big Brothers and Big Sisters here in Juneau, about the size and some of the different programs that you have.
Yeah, we have currently around about 100 matches, and we have about 40 youth waiting for bigs, some people in the process of being matched up. It's always a revolving door. Matches aging out and new matches coming in. And we have a few programs volunteers can be matched in. Often people think about the community-based program where you would drive around with your little and do all the stuff that you love to do already, go to the rock dump or skiing or out for hot chocolate, but just every once in a while bring a little buddy along with you. And then there's also the school-based program, which is where volunteers would meet up with their littles in the school, and it's usually easier to schedule the school-based program because you just think, oh yeah, every Thursday or Wednesday I meet up with little Jeremy at lunch or you know, whatever it is. So the community-based program is more you schedule each hangout. It's a little more dynamic.
Okay, and that's what you participate in, right,
yes.
Leslie? Yeah, so tell us a little bit about your little.
Well, my little is energetic, 10 and a half years old, and we have very eclectic interests. We tend to do art, the things that are arranged through Big Brothers Big Sisters through the canvas or through the museum, City Museum. We've also loved to go to the rock dump. We hike, and I took her bushwhacking on the Industrial Boulevard Wetlands Trail the other day, and she enjoyed just striking off through the underbrush to see what was there. That was really fun. And we walk the dog. We go out to, like, Nugget Falls and do stuff like that. We do a lot of arts and crafts things. We play games, board games, dominoes, and games like that. Sometimes, because she lives in Douglas and I live kind of far out the road, we might meet someplace like Foodland and, you know, get something to eat at the salad bar and then sit down at a table and play dominoes or draw or do whatever we want to do. Or Froyo's is another one of her favorite places. So it's, you know, it's not an expensive enterprise. It's just a lot of fun. And we might go from anywhere from an hour. I think our longest one was 6.5 hours. And just do kind of whatever.
Yeah, and you've been with Maya for what, 2 years?
A little over 2 years.
And thinking back, what inspired you to become a big, and what was that process like?
Well, I had been a big back when I was in college for one year, and then my son has been in it for some time in as a community member, actually as a school, during the school program. Ben Lyman had a little for, like 7 years or something.
Long time.
So he was inspirational, and kind of, I was waiting to be retired enough to be able to make the commitment, and finally got there.
Mm-hmm. So. And what is the actual process? Maybe both of you can chime in on becoming one.
Well, you would just give us a call. Our number is 586-3350. You can call me. I'm the one who does a lot of the enrollment, me and another coworker. And, you know, the call can just be a little inquiry. I could tell you more about the program, more about exactly what it would look like to be a big. And from there, we would schedule an interview. We have a little orientation where we give you an in-depth look at what you can really expect. And then we do some background checks and, you know, the DMV checks and all that stuff. And then we work on matching you up. And the process, you know, varies based on where people are, and some people have moved, or some people are hard to track down, but usually it doesn't take too long to match up somebody with a kid, with a little.
All right, and it sounds like you have 40 youths waiting to be matched.
Yeah, about that. That seems to be the number that it's kind of floating around there.
So 40 of our listeners today,
yep.
If they could give you a call at 586-3350, would be a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. And having a pool that big, it's kind of nice because I get to read through all the kids and interview all of them, and it's amazing how dynamic they all are. So you might have a personality where, yeah, I don't really like to do stuff out in the community, or I don't like to go to the rock dump or be super active, but we have kids waiting who could fit right along with that, and no matter what you like to do, there's someone out there who is probably pretty similar.
Leslie, do you remember having a mentor in your life and the importance that he or she may have had on you?
My brother. My brother was my mentor, and he was extremely important, and it's probably very, you know, instrumental in shaping who I am today, what his values were. And just having somebody take the time to just focus on you is just a very empowering thing for a person, I think. Mm-hmm. And for a little kid, there was actually a little guy who was just begging me this afternoon to let him come with me since his big sister wasn't around to come. He said, "Take me, take me." He's like, "Oh, I would love to, but you know, that's not quite kosher." So, but I know there are really neat kids waiting.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, I think you've answered this to a certain extent already. But what is the perfect volunteer? or who are you looking for? How would you describe someone who does well as a big?
First and foremost, I'm looking for people who want to do it. You know, we get so much awesome feedback from our volunteers, and I get the privilege of actually supporting Leslie and Maya's match, and so I get to be in the middle and check in with Leslie and hear how she's affected and how Maya is affected as well and how much they are changing throughout the years. So the kind of person we're looking for is someone who's just excited to build a friendship with a youth in the community. And, yeah, there's...
It sounds like they can have diverse interests.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like people know when they want to do it. They know when they want to be a volunteer and want to be a mentor and if this is a good time for you. You know, the commitments aren't huge. In the community-based program, it's about two to four hangouts per month. So every other weekend, you just get a hang out with your little. In the school-based program, it's once a week. You, for about 40 minutes, go visit at lunch or play at recess or board games. Yeah.
Okay, and for more info, you can call Joe here, Joe Clark, the program specialist at Big Brothers Big Sisters at 586-3350.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and I guess we might get to see you again this month as the month goes on. And
yeah, probably.
Maybe, hopefully meet a couple more bigs and maybe a little mm-hmm. here and there.
Yeah, we want to have a couple come on too, a big couple. We like to advertise that, you know, if you think you might not be able to make the commitment alone, and if you have a significant other, you can be a match together.
Okay.
And when Joe said age out, he really meant the littles. The bigs don't ever age out, right?
Yeah, right. Or, you know, they'll graduate from high school.
Right.
All right, Leslie and Joe, thanks for your time today. The number is 586-3350 to become a big. Anything we're missing, you two?
Yeah, you could also stop. We're right across the street from the Rookery downtown. Just stop on in, and if you have any questions, if you're walking around.
All right, thanks, you too.
Okay,
right,
thank you.
an extraordinary man.
A man who created greatness.
A man who moved millions.
Perseverance Theater is proud to present the two-time award-winning play, The Mountaintop, by Katori Hall. Mysterious, humorous, and heartbreaking, The Mountaintop is a unique endeavor into the imagined last night before Reverend Martin Luther King's assassination. Opening on January 9th, find out more at ptalaska.org, Heartside Books, or call 463-TIXX.
It's about 12 minutes until the top of the hour. You're listening to A Juno Afternoon. Scott Burton, your host here, and now in the studio is Lori Craig, the lead naturalist at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center Forest Service. Welcome, Lori. How are you today?
Hi, Scott. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Fireside lectures start this Friday.
They do. You know, this is one of the most fun aspects of my job at the Visitor Center, which a lot of people think, oh, are you going back there? And I said, well, I'm there year-round, which is wonderful. We do have staff that are permanent, and the Visitor Center is open during the wintertime, although a lot of people don't think about it. We're open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 10 to 4, and there's no charge in the wintertime.
That's great. And you have 12 lectures coming up as part of this series, and let's get to that in just a sec. Tell me about the history of the Fireside Lecture. How did it get its name? When did it start?
Well, the Fireside Lectures, of course, everybody thinks it's the Fireside Chats that President Roosevelt did. But actually, the history in Juneau is that these lectures were part of when the Visitor Center started in 1962, K.J. Metcalf, who is still here in town, inspired these lectures, and they were held in front of the big hearth and the fireplace. We had great big logs and crackling fires, and it was wonderful, and it was very warm when you would come into the Visitor Center. It was so great to come into this only one room in the building, in addition to the little restaurant in the corner. But we would have lectures right in front of the fireplace, so that's why they were called the Fireside Lectures. And as the fire burned hotter and hotter, we started moving back farther and farther because it was getting really warm, and we all had wool sweaters on because nobody had fleece back then, wool or halibut jackets. And pretty soon it started to smell like a bunch of wet dogs. But we all love wet dogs, so it was fun. And the lectures were designed to help us learn about natural resources. That's still my mandate, is to find things that will help educate the public on happenings around Juneau that are related to natural history, whether it's human or cultural or some scientific thing. So I try to get a broad spectrum of history, and we've got brown bears this year, we've got seals, we've got whales, we've got wolves. We've also got the wreck of the Princess Sophia. That's one of Juneau's enduring stories, sad as it is, and we're going to learn a little bit more. Juneau is blessed with many experts that can talk well on so many different topics, and we have a great auditorium with a wonderful projection system. So we watch great big pictures on a screen that's about 15 by 20, and we watch wonderful stories being told by people who know what they're talking about. So I'm very happy to just provide a venue, and the series has become very popular. We have two lectures a night. This is every Friday night in January, February, and March. The lectures are free. Doors open at 6 o'clock. The first lecture begins at 6:30. And there's a little break for Oreos and coffee in between, and then the second lecture repeats at 8 o'clock. Doors open at 6, but we have people clamoring for seats, so if you're not there by 6:20, you're probably not going to get a seat.
That first one.
We have an overflow in the area where the hearth is, where the fire is. And these days, it's a digital fire. But we pretend.
Very eco-friendly, sustainable.
It is, and
fire.
That's really important when you've got a melting glacier a mile and a half away. We want to keep it as long as we can.
All right, so this Friday, speaking of experts, who is your first speaker?
Our first speaker is John Neary, who happens to be our director at the Visitor Center. And he's got a wonderful history of his own. He was one of the people that worked for the Forest Service for more than 30 years and basically started Pack Creek as we know it today as a place to visit with bears. And he loves Admiralty Island. He will be talking about, and he'll be here on Friday at the radio station to talk about pack rafting on the historical trail that goes across Admiralty Island by water.
Okay, and then the next week?
Oh, the next week, this is another water one. Jim Garrity, who's one of my favorite people, is a wonderful local historian. He'll be talking about the various bridges that went across the Mendenhall River. We actually had a covered bridge here, but a lot of people don't know that. He does some wonderful research, gets great pictures. He'll be at the Visitor Center on the 16th of January.
Okay, and I'm looking at the dates here. It looks like they're just about every week through the end of March.
Right. Every Friday night, this is the place to be. This is great for date nights, for couples to come and have a little fun when they come to the glacier. Sometimes it's really packed. So what people have told me is if you want to come, here's the trick. If you're coming at 6:30, be sure you're there by about 6 or 6:10 to get a parking place. If you want to come at 8 o'clock, get your car, come into the parking lot at about 7:50. That means all the people for the first show were starting to leave, and you might get a parking space near the front. Otherwise, you're going to be way down the road. So some of the tricks to parking and coming to visit us. We're delighted that these lectures are well received by people. Now, this is a 12 different lectures. I know people can't remember all of them. So our partners, Alaska Geographic, who operates the bookstores, they are our nonprofit partner at the Visitor Center, have posted this lecture schedule on their website. So all I have to do is go to alaskageographic.org. Along the left-hand margin are several different things. You can go to waypoints and click on that, and you'll see a nice mention of our lectures and each one of them, so you can document what it is that you'd like to see. And if anybody wants me to email them the lecture series, the poster, I'm happy to do that. I do a little promotion every week that gives more details than you see on the poster. I can easily be reached at the Visitor Center. My email address is lcraig@fs, which stands for Forest Service, .fed for federal, .us. lcraig@fs.fed.us. And I'm happy to send people news and photos. I just sent out some photos the other day of an iceberg that rolled on Friday afternoon in brilliant blue, so everybody got to see a picture of it. And it reminds people to be safe on the ice, too.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. What are the conditions out there right now, and how should people travel?
Well, one of the things that we want to be sure everybody can do is walk safely to the visitor center. So we have heat in the path that melts the ice, so you can walk on a little path and see how to get there. The parking lots are graveled, and you can make it to the visitor center, but beyond that, you are going to be sliding around. It's like everything is completely coated with ice. The kids have been having a blast. On the little slope that we normally walk down to get to the lake, the kids just sit down and scoot. And yesterday there was this great pileup of kids. There were four of them in one big pile. It was like watching otters play. They're all rolling around each other, and they're padded in their snowsuits, and they're having a great time. But if you want to walk, bring your ice cleats, because it's pretty slick out there right now. But great for ice skating once you get on the lake.
And once you're on the lake, are there boundaries that people should respect, staying away from icebergs?
Absolutely. Now, we don't mark boundaries. There's no way we can do that. The way you've got to mark it is in your brain. And that is stay away from the terminus, because the glacier continues to calve. We document the calvings. There's one about every week. And what happens is that breaks up the terminus. So if you see blue ice, stay away from it. And then this iceberg that rolled over on Friday midday, which we got to watch, and that's always really cool, is right off Photo Point. Within 24 hours, people were playing on it. So everyone has to walk past a sign that says something about caution for the ice safety. But that whole lake can break up if something happens, like a rock slide. And I'm one of the few people that watched half of the lake break up one Tuesday afternoon after it had been 15 degrees for 2 weeks. Ironically, that was my personal mental idea of I won't go out on the lake until it's been cold for 2 weeks, really, really cold. And that's what happened. And it turned that lake into snow cone ice. And it has cautioned me about ever going out on the east side of the lake anymore.
What are the hours, again, of the center in the winter?
From 10 in the morning till 4. And okay. It's free, and that's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I want to speak to parents about this, because our bookstore, which again is operated by Alaska Geographic in the summertime, is closed down in the winter, and we have it all set up for kids. So we have puzzles and puppets and all kinds of things, books. It's a great place for kids to just relax with their parents.
All right. Fireside lectures start this Friday. The center is open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can go to alaskageographic.org for more information on the fireside lectures. If someone just wants information on the center, where should they go?
They can call us at 789-0097. That number is listed in the phone book as well. And we will answer their questions. They can always email me, and I will be happy to give them any information we have.
All right, Lori, great talking to you. I hope you come back soon and keep us updated on some of the lectures that are coming up.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, we'll get a preview of this week's Wildlife Wednesday presentation, seeing what we can see with guests Mary Wilson and Kathy Hawker. Donnie Burras will offer an update on activities at the Zach Gordon Youth Center. We'll get a preview of Wednesday's Alaska Design Forum at the Gold Town Theater. And Jeff Reclow and Matt Lillard will highlight activities at Eagle Crest, that Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more Wednesday on a Juno afternoon. The weather tonight, snow likely with periods of light freezing drizzle. Snow accumulation 1 to 4 inches, lows 23 to 29, northeast wind 15 to 25 with gusts to around 35 miles per hour. Wednesday, windy, snow, heavy at times, rain south of Taku Inlet, snow accumulation 5 to 10 inches possible, high is 27 to 33, northeast wind 20 to 30 miles per hour, shifting to the southeast in the afternoon, wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.